The next faculty member I interviewed was Dr. Andrew Evans, and to begin, I asked him about a major cooperative group clinical trial he chairs, evaluating upfront and maintenance treatment of follicular lymphoma.
On our ongoing ECOG 2408 study, that's the one where we're standard arm is a bendamustine rituximab backbone followed by 2 years of rituximab, and we're integrating in one arm bortezomib to the induction, and in another arm integrating lenalidomide into what we're calling consolidation. And so we're hopeful that we're going to go back and we're collecting tissue, we're collecting blood, that we'll be able to find something that's truly predictive. In other words, not just prognostic. Randy Gascoigne talks a lot about this, that we have a lot of prognostic markers in lymphoma, and you could argue that in all of cancer, but we need more predictive markers. So if you have this molecular finding, this many macrophages, or this type of gene expression profiling in your tumor tissue, you should receive bortezomib, or you should receive lenalidomide, or you should receive ibrutinib, or you should receive adalimumab. And so I think part of it might be tumor-based, but also they're probably going to be kind of drug-based. And obviously that's the whole personalized therapy holy grail that we're all looking for, but that's exactly the research we need to do, and we're doing it. It's just trying to cobble that all together. I can just add one other thing. We're also checking, analyzing host genetics, because I think that's obviously another piece of the puzzle, that it's, yes, the tumor's part of it, but what about the host SNPs and how we process these medications? I thought that was really interesting data that came out of the LIM 3001. I don't know if you remember that study, Neil. That was one that was, people would argue, mainly a negative study. So it was relapsed follicular lymphoma. Randomized study, largest randomized study ever done in follicular lymphoma, over 500 patients randomized to rituximab or rituximab bortezomib. Coiffier was the first author. There was a statistical improvement of 1.8 months, but everyone would agree not clinically meaningful.
All right, everybody was disappointed about that.
So negative study, what I think has not gotten as much press has been a follow-up publication, I think in clinical cancer research, although it could have been, I think it was CCR, where they had embedded a lot of correlative analyses. And what came out in the wash was two factors, CD68, so how many macrophages you had in the tumor, and a particular proteasomal host SNP. And if you had both of these factors, there was a huge difference. In fact, an overall survival difference for bortezomib. Now, it was retrospective. It wasn't, we're going to need to put that in prospective studies, but I think we need a lot more of that, of not just treating random patient populations and hoping everyone benefits or a certain percent benefit, but obviously finding those predictive markers. And it's likely not going to be one smoking gun like ER, PR, positive, negative. We're going to have to cobble together these different analyses.
You know, that study is really interesting in another respect, in that it has a bendamustine control. And even though nowadays, you know, it looks to me from what we can tell in our surveying that, in fact, BR has replaced R-CHOP to a very great extent, even in the younger patients. But yet you guys designed this before that was actually really clarified.
We took a little bit of a risk, I guess you could say. In fact, the reason it's 2408, that's what ECOG, the initial study was 1408. And I can tell you, ECOG 1408, when we first submitted it to CTEP, had R-CHOP backbone. So we had gotten that back, and that was just around the second time, I think, Rummel presented at ASH.
He initially
presented the PR data.
Yep.
He initially presented the safety data showing it was less toxic. Then he started showing the efficacy data that it was better, at least PFS-wise. So we had a real searching of the souls, and that's when Brad Call was taking over the group. And we said, well, we don't want to go forward with this big 300-patient randomized phase 2 study and then be irrelevant that we've added bortezomib and lenalidomide, because we knew we wanted to go with that concept to try and make induction better, try and make consolidation better. So we just swapped out the backbone. But yeah, I guess you could argue it was a little bit of a risk at the time.
Yeah, you know, because I remember when Rombo first presented that day, I think it was ASH 2009. And, you know, the initial reaction was not that positive. I mean, the whole first year, there was a lot of, I mean, the docs in practice, I think, actually responded kind of more favorably because it kind of reminded them, I think, of TC and breast cancer. But the investigators were very kind of muted for the first year about BR, so that was kind of a gutsy thing to do, but I guess it worked.
Yeah. Well, in the study, and maybe that's a negative of the cooperative groups, didn't officially open until the end of 2011, early 2012. So he had a few years of kind of cultivated data. It wasn't totally out on a limb. He had some of his pretty mature efficacy data that we were able to discuss with him.
Right. And then subsequently, we saw the so-called BRIGHT study, which also addressed a similar question. As you look at it today and sort of put everything together, because there with the BRIGHT study, the toxicity data wasn't quite the same and the efficacy, although I think it's still a little bit early. But bottom line, when you put this together, is this more a sort of toxicity-based decision?
I think it is. And so I think that was a super important, or is or was a super important study led by Ian Flynn, in that nothing against the Rummel data and that publication, but sometimes you see different things with different studies, even though it's the same regimen. And so I would say that makes more sense to me, I think. In other words, efficacy about the same in terms of not a superiority of BR over R-CHOP, at least in follicular lymphoma. Now, maybe in mantle cell, something else is going to flesh out. But what I would say with toxicity, though, is probably less toxic, but I would also say just different toxicities, frankly. You know, obviously with R-CHOP, you see alopecia, but in terms of other real toxicities, there is going to be the increased neurotoxicity with vincristine, slight increased risk of infections with some slightly more intensive, but BR is not totally a walk in the park. I mean, you do see some toxicities, and we're seeing it in our study as well. For example, we'll see this, albeit uncommon, skin rash, almost like an allergic sensitivity to bendamustine rituximab. I've had a few patients. It's actually been quite severe. We've had to stop drug and give steroids, et cetera. And I've also seen, maybe anecdotally, increased nausea, vomiting, more so with BR than I would expect, more than R-CHOP. So there's a patient population, you have to be cautious there.
So I want to ask you also about another ASH paper, and it ties in also to your trial too, in that when I first heard about this trial, I was really struck by what you call consolidation, some people call maintenance, where you're combining lenalidomide and rituximab. I'm going to ask you later about a paper at ASH with that combination up front in mantle cell. But in your study, what is the control arm and exactly what happens in terms of the experimental arm?
So control arm, after BR induction for 6 cycles, we're giving 2 years of rituximab maintenance according to the Gila schedule. In other words, every 2 months or every 8 weeks, we're giving that. And so in the second experimental arm, we actually chose the word, it's a little bit of play on words, we chose the word continuation. And the reason we're either going continuation or consolidation, the reason we're not calling it maintenance is we're not using a maintenance dose of lenalidomide. We're using 20 milligrams for a year. So it's really not maintenance therapy. And we saw it as continuation, almost like consolidation, almost like a second formal treatment that we're giving patients. It's just a strategy we took. I know Mitchell Smith in his mantle cell study where they're incorporating lenalidomide, they're giving it for 2 years at a lower, more like a maintenance dose. But we took the tack that, well, it is follicular lymphoma. We don't want patients to be on lenalidomide. You know, we want to have our cake and eat it too. We want high remission rates, long survival, but not a lot of side effects. So we rationalize that. Let's just give a year of lenalidomide, but give it at a good enough dose where we can see effect.
So I've got my money that the experimental maintenance or continuation arm is going to be effective. I also am kind of optimistic, even though people are a little bit down on bortezomib, that if you find a marker, I bet you there are some patients who are going to benefit if you can figure out who it is.
I agree. I think we are going to see it. I think especially on that one correlative analysis I had alluded to from the LIM 3001 study that
right.
We have to enrich that patient population. That if, again, yeah, you look at a whole heterogeneous patient population, but if we enrich it down, I think we will see that impact.
So, you know, 2 years of R maintenance has kind of also become a standard coming after BR now in the last couple of years. But I was curious about your thoughts about a paper coming out of SAC at ASH looking at 5 years of maintenance.
Yeah, that is interesting. And to me, it to a certain extent conflicts with the resort data a little
totally.
Bit.
Totally. I mean, it's kind of the resort data, except they stop at 5 years.
So, and again, all these things, it's always kind of how you slice it. Now, when you look at the curves from that ASH presentation, and obviously we'll wait to see the formal publication, but officially, the primary endpoint was not significant. The p-value, I think, was 0.14. So,
and that was progression-free survival.
Yeah, it was either progression-free or event-free, but
It wasn't survival.
Yeah, right. It was not overall survival. So, yeah, which was negative. So even just looking at PFS or EFS, it was not significant. They had to do a retrospective unplanned analysis, almost a landmark analysis. In other words, it wasn't intent to treat, which I think you can't do. I mean, it has to be an intent to treat analysis if it's a randomized study.
Well, I thought what they did was just, and to me, they could have designed the trial like that legitimately, I think, which was just look at the patients at the point where they diverged.
Correct.
Even though they weren't randomized, if you would wait until they got to the point where they either stopped or continued, then the trial was positive.
Which is what the PRIMA study was, right? Like you could get right. any dealer's choice, and then we're going to start the study then, right? So, yeah, you could say, is that okay to do? I'm a little more of a statistical purist that you can't kind of go back and try and reinvent. There's just biases and things that change. But, yeah, when they did go back on this unplanned analysis, it then became significant for progression-free survival. So, as we know, the RESORT study, and the endpoint wasn't exactly the same, but when RESORT looked at it, at least in follicular lymphoma, that there was not a difference after you gave those first 4 weeks to continuing maintenance versus not.
And of course, the other thing about that always struck me about RESORT is how well those people did who just got the four doses.
Did amazingly well. Now, there's going to be three papers that'll be published. One is the main paper by Brad Call. The two kind of sub-papers to that are going to be quality of life. They did really nice detailed quality of life analyses. Lynn Wagner from Northwestern led that. And then there was a non-follicular component that Mike Williams has presented that's going to be published as well. So, and at least the theme to that, interestingly, although I haven't talked to Mike on any biologic basis, is that there did seem to be more of a benefit to maintenance if you were non-follicular. In other words, marginal zone, SLL, et cetera. So I'm excited to see that data and if there are any differences.
Yeah, quality of life is always tricky. Sometimes I have a hard time sort of figuring out what it means, but I don't know if, like, buried in there, if you had 10% of people relapsing who wouldn't relapse, would you actually pick it up on a quality of life thing where you're looking at everybody?
Well, I think you might, but I think they're also looking at anxiety of not getting or getting.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
And kind of just all of those layers implemented, or patients who had to come to the clinic didn't have to come. Is that good or bad, et cetera?
Anyhow, I guess the bottom line is we continue with 2 years of standard. Is that right?
Well, I would say bottom line, we continue with 2 years of standard for high-risk follicular lymphoma. And to me, that's something that is important that sometimes gets lost. The Europeans have been very good about it in their studies for 20 years. In other words, only treating patients who need a reason to treat. The most common criteria are the GELF criteria. In other words, if you have B symptoms, obviously you're not going to wait to treat. Or if you have cytopenias, if you have, it's compressing an organ, bulk is maybe a little bit of a softer criteria. But for high-risk patients, yes, I would say the standard is R-chemo followed by 2 years of rituximab maintenance. But for low-risk, which RESORT was, in other words, you don't have a reason to treat, I would say that for me, I could tell you my personal standard is still watchful waiting. In those, I would say maybe at most it would be 4 weeks of rituximab and then wait, no maintenance.
Yeah, I hear people also talking about trying to delay, you know, older people getting chemo as a strategy.
Sure. I think that's a valid point.
So another paper I want to ask you about from ASH, because it ties into some comments that occurred. You were part of a think tank, and I was kind of surprised there because Julie Vose brought up this question of using radioimmune therapy instead of R maintenance in situations where she was going to consider R maintenance. She brought up the issue of convenience, et cetera, et cetera. And I actually hadn't heard too many people express that sentiment. And yet here at ASH, there was a paper looking at, looked like a comparison between those two strategies. What did you think about that?
It was. Yeah, I don't think it was powered for a phase three, but it was right. A randomized phase two.
Correct.
And they basically either gave 2 years of rituximab maintenance or one dose of ipratumumab tiaxetam. And I was a little surprised by the results. At least the PFS analysis was favoring the rituximab. I frankly was one that I thought it would be a wash at the end of the day, but
I did
it
too.
Did look a little bit better. Obviously, it's not mature. We need to follow those results out. It was better. You know, to me, I'm not sure it'll change practice per se. I think, yes, the standard still is 2 years of rituximab, but if for whatever situation there was a patient situation where I'm going to go on a 18-month cruise, but I want maintenance, or I'm going to go to Alaska for, you could give them one dose of ipratumumab tiaxetam, and you might get close to as much as 2 years. But I think, yeah, generally speaking, it was interesting data.
So another thing I wanted to ask you about, particularly given your maintenance arm and your ECOG study of lenalidomide rituximab, is that strategy, the so-called R-squared regimen, the non-chemotherapy approach. And we saw a paper at ASH looking at this as upfront therapy in mantle cell, and I wonder what you thought about that.
Yeah, Gia Roon from Cornell presented that data, and I thought it was interesting, and I guess not surprising that we know lenalidomide has pretty good activity in mantle cell lymphoma. Obviously, it's FDA approved now. And they saw high response rates, maybe not as high as if you had used our chemotherapy. I think what will be interesting in that analysis will certainly be, is it durable or not? Now, they're giving it a full dose, lenalidomide, for, I believe, 48 weeks, and then they are continuing on a lower dose of lenalidomide. So to me, it'll be critical on the durability, but also I want to look more at the patient population. They had some certain criteria in there. I don't think they were taking high-risk patients in that study, so maybe there is a lower-risk patient population that you don't need to rush in with chemotherapy, number one. And number two, obviously that was done kind of pre-ibrutinib, and so ibrutinib is going to be a game-changer, at least in mantle cell lymphoma.
And in that regard, I mean, also you have the issue of people with comorbidities and very elderly people, where, you know, even something like bendamustine might be something you want to avoid. Are there situations now where you've tried to get, for example, ibrutinib up front?
We've been thinking about it. I haven't done it yet, but I think it makes sense for a patient who you don't want to give not just bendamustine, but you think can't tolerate any chemotherapy. I think that is going to become more common. And obviously, there's going to be studies looking at frontline ibrutinib. And I think, yeah, looking at all the drugs on as level as a playing field as you can, ibrutinib is the most active non-chemotherapeutic. There's no way around it in a relapse refractory patient population. I had patients on one of the pivotal studies, and it has really remarkable activity. It's an anecdote. I can tell you, I had a patient who was 75, had failed three chemotherapy regimens. He was a pretty hardy 75-year-old, but had failed three chemo regimens within about a 2.5-3 year span, so really short remissions. And one of those treatments, we had added bortezomib, he failed that. He actually enrolled on the lenalidomide pivotal study, progressed on that. And this was a patient who had these big, bulky subcutaneous masses, huge. Some of them were 6-7 centimeters, and went on the ibrutinib study and was in a CR by 4 months. So it's just in resistant patients, remarkable activity.
What's your current algorithm in recurrent mantle cell? Where does lenalidomide fit in, bortezomib and ibrutinib, and how do you sequence them?
Well, it's tough. It's been reset because, yeah, lenalidomide was just approved a few months ago, and obviously ibrutinib just a month ago approved. So it's kind of recalibrating as we speak and trying to think about it. I think I'm still a slight purist in that you like to see data, at least good phase two data, if not randomized data, to push you one way or another. But I think off of a clinical trial, obviously I'd recommend a clinical trial, frontline or relapsed, but off of a clinical trial, I still would say for a younger patient, our chemotherapy, and at least personally, I've advocated auto transplant and first remission, I think would still be the standard. Now, is ibrutinib going to change that? Very possibly, and we'll need to see that frontline data. For an older patient, I've liked the data from Mayo Clinic for the older patient using purine analogs, cladribine. Frontline, I've had either that or bendamustine frontline. So the question is, yeah, is there going to be a patient where you would not use chemotherapy? And I think if that arose, it probably would be rituximab or ibrutinib frontline off of a clinical study for that comorbid patient. But I think for first relapse, it's going to be hard not to integrate ibrutinib into second-line therapy in some way or another, whether as a single agent. And I think, obviously, we know there's studies ongoing combining it with chemotherapy. There's data combining it with R-CHOP, but it'll be interesting to see how do we integrate it with other chemotherapeutics.
What about the sequence in terms of lenalidomide and bortezomib? I think the way it's approved, you're supposed to use bortezomib first.
That is how it is approved. You are. As you know, sometimes we'll use it slightly off-label, and if there's compendia used, et cetera. I don't know. I think, to me, in mantle cell lymphoma, in a post-ibrutinib world, I think if lenalidomide's going to have an impact, a real impact, it's probably going to be more in the maintenance type of strategy. So that's where I think the E1411 study that Mitchell Smith is leading, which is basically identical to the E2408 study, except they have a fourth arm where they're doing both bortezomib, adding it to BR induction, and giving lenalidomide maintenance for 2 years. So they have four total arms in that study. I think that's going to be really interesting, especially the both arms, frankly, the bortezomib induction part and the lenalidomide maintenance part. You could think, could we get to a world or a study where we have a frontline study that's R, ibrutinib, lenalidomide, bortezomib in some combination or cocktail, if not all four, maybe three of those four, and maybe sequencing some of them up front induction and some into maintenance. And so literally a non-chemotherapy world for mantle cell lymphoma. I think that's where we're heading.
Just a practical question about using bortezomib in the standard situation of relapsed mantle cell. Are you using it sub-Q?
I am, and I'll use it and sometimes try to off-study in follicular. But yes, in mantle cell, all patients, if we're able to use it, which we are mostly able to in all patients, sub-Q.
So just to finish out on R-squared, where are we right now in studies of that up front? I know there's the big randomized phase 3 relevance trial, basically comparing R-squared to R-chemo up front. What's the status of R-squared up front?
So the U.S. lead to that study is Nathan Fowler, and I think it's an interesting study. It's actually a bold design. It's a very large randomized study. They're not just looking at an inferiority design. It's actually, they're looking to see, can R squared beat R chemo, superiority, at least in terms of progression-free survival. So it's interesting. You know, there was good data that MD Anderson published frontline that showed it was active. We'll see.
And then I think the CLGB, then they published also some data on
this. They did. It was a smaller phase 2.
Where they presented it, actually.
I'm not sure on the risk of those patients. In other words, were all those high risk? And to me, that was a critique of the Fowler data, was there was a mixture of low risk, in other words, like resort-like patients,
right,
and high risk. So for true high-risk patients, it'll be interesting. I would be very surprised if it beats our chemo. I could conceivably see where it's similar in efficacy, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it will beat our chemotherapy. To me, what would be surprising would be that it wasn't as if lenalidomide in relapsed follicular lymphoma was an incredibly active therapy. So I could never understand, well, why in relapsed follicular lymphoma, when the response rate is 25, at most 30%, is it all of a sudden more active frontline? Maybe it is, but we'll have to see.
Now, when you say it's not that active with R?
So with R, it's more active as a single agent. In other words, like we see ibrutinib's activity as a single agent.
Right. Well, that's the magic of the lenalidomide monoclonal antibody thing.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. So
supposedly.
Maybe there is
some. We see
that
myeloma too with the elotuzumab, same thing. Elotuzumab and lenalidomide, but whatever.
Yeah, it's possible there is some magical synergy between the two drugs. So we'll have to see. But I'm hopeful what they've included in that study, again, are some correlative studies. So even though maybe it's a negative study, again, you can find a subgroup of patients, whether macrophages or SNPs or something that really benefits from a non-chemo frontline strategy.
So you were talking about, you know, older patient, 90 years old, you know, multiple comorbidities, et cetera, trying to avoid initial chemotherapy when you were talking about ibrutinib and mantle cell. And I'm always curious about the, you know, studies looking at that issue. And I saw at ASH, there was actually a poster or something I've been really curious about. I've been asking people about. It's the same concept, but in terms of brentuximab vedotin, Hodgkin lymphoma. And this was just a, you know, small phase 2 study, but they did look at it in people over age 60, which I guess makes you old nowadays.
It does.
But anyhow.
It does. No, and that was an interesting study. I personally have a competing study to that study that I'm involved with, and we've published in the last couple of years on, actually, we're not calling it elderly Hodgkin's. We're calling it Hodgkin's in older patients. I don't know if that makes a difference or makes you feel any better.
Yeah, I think so.
But
that sounds different.
Yeah, elderly sometimes is a negative connotation. But so we took the strategy, and the study's ongoing, of that. Part of it is a comorbidity issue, but part of it is this is a more malignant, virulent disease in older patients. And we do know that you see much more mixed cellularity. You see much more EBV-related disease. You see much more advanced stage disease in the elderly or older patients versus younger patients. And when you look at the differences in overall survival, and yeah, someone could argue 60 is an arbitrary cut point, but that's what most of this data and studies have done over the last 20, 30 years for Hodgkin's lymphoma or many lymphomas. But you know, we looked at among the 2496, which was the Stanford 5 ABVD study, that was a negative study, equal efficacy. There were 43 patients who were over age 60. And the difference in PFS, FFS, and OS was more than 30 to 40 percentage points worse in that older patient subgroup, which we know age is a negative prognostic factor, but usually not 40 percentage points worse. And so we argued that tolerability of therapy was one point, but a second point was it's a more aggressive disease. So that as a backdrop, we designed our study as, well, what's the standard? There is no standard. We called AVD the standard, so typical ABVD with no bleomycin, because in that ECOG study and other studies, I think we underestimate the risk of bleomycin lung toxicity in older patients, which can be fatal, as you know. But our study is, so what we decided, let's integrate B-vedotin. So what we designed it as two initial, almost like a window study, two initial doses of B-vedotin, then chemotherapy, and then post-chemotherapy, more B-vedotin as consolidation. We rationalized that it just would be too much for older patients to do concurrently. So that's the ongoing study.
So did you think about, or I mean, I imagine you're putting patients on the study, and I imagine you'll see people responding after two doses of B-vedotin, which sort of links up with this phase two study, which is what they used. I mean, could you imagine maintaining somebody who's 90 years old with heart disease on B-vedotin so they don't die of their Hodgkin?
Right. So I think that's the critical point is going to be that study that you're alluding to showed a pretty respectable response rate, and they're using just single agent B-vedotin, no chemotherapy. So to me, the critical aspect to that study is it going to be durable with just B-vedotin? Because it is chemotherapy, but obviously it's more of a antitubulin-like agent. And we know every study, what's the most important drug, or at least what I would argue would be the alkylator, the dacarbazine. Maybe the second most important is the anthracycline. So to me, the critical thing, I'm maybe not so surprised on the initial response rate. What's going to be important is, can you maintain that? Are you going to start seeing relapses because you don't have that alkylator or other chemotherapeutic? So we're going to need to see that part of that study.
Yeah, that will be interesting. Although, I mean, they report 9 out of 11 people responding, including a 92-year-old woman who had a CR that I see here in their chart.
Yeah, well, and clearly, even though our study has sequential chemotherapy, there are going to be patients that probably 92-year-olds, a good example, who could not tolerate chemotherapy. And I think it is an attractive strategy.
When you see responses to B-vedotin and Hodgkin, how long does it usually take?
Pretty quick, I think, within two cycles. So yeah, we did build in an exploratory PET scan after the two lead-in cycles. So I'm not at liberty to give the efficacy data yet, but I think that will be interesting. Neil, I don't know if you want me to talk about, but what we did report at ASH is we had pancreatitis related to B-vedotin. Did you want to go down that alley?
Yeah. How many patients did you report?
Well, so, and it's in, I can tell you, it should be Impressive Blood. It should be coming out any day now.
This was an oral or poster at ASH?
So it should have been an oral, but anyways, it was a poster at ASH.
Huh.
But so it was a poster at ASH, and it was basically pancreatitis associated B-vedotin.
Huh.
And I can tell you the index case that set off that examination of literature and patients was a patient on the aforementioned elderly study. So there was a patient who was on that study who was 65 years old, female, had stage 2 bulky disease, but had a performance status of 0, enrolled on the study after the first dose of single agent B-vedotin, had some side effects, had diarrhea, had abdominal pain, but that resolved, got the second dose, and 9 days after the second dose was admitted with pancreatitis and died a week later.
Wow.
Had no risk factors, did not drink, and she actually had an autopsy, and there was no gallstones. And interestingly, two interesting findings on autopsy. One was the pancreas was completely necrotic, totally
wow.
Necrotic, number one. Number two, interestingly, her tumor at autopsy, she was NED. The tumor was completely necrotic as well. So at least we weren't collecting PKs in terms of dose levels of the MMAE chemotherapeutic, but at least it makes you think, did she just have a hyper response in some way, tumor and pancreas? And I can tell you if we pulled, which we did, and we reached out to Volker Diehl, who discovered CD30 antigen. If you look at that original blood, I think 1998 paper, where is CD30 expressed? One of the few normal tissues, is CD30 expressed on exocrine pancreas cells? And you have to now, part of it is what antibody you use on that IHC. And so we did kind of a high-res IHC, and she did have CD30 on her exocrine pancreas cells. So we went and really just did a grassroots email every lymphoma expert we could think of, and we were able to scrap together 9 total cases. So a low number. And I think that's obviously an important theme, as this isn't a super high risk in any way. In fact, it's very rare risk of it, but I think it's real, because what I can tell you, what to me, albeit indirectly, proves it, is there were 2 patients in our series that's being reported, that was at ASH and hopefully will get published soon, was 2 patients were retreated and had pancreatitis a second time on retreatment. So they initially had pancreatitis, stopped drug, months or a year later got retreated again and had pancreatitis again.
Wow. Is pancreatic cancer CD30 positive?
I don't know. Maybe they should look at it, because
I wonder if they have looked at it. I assume not. I thought they looked at everything.
Well, what I would say is you could almost argue that even if pancreatic cancer isn't, it's going to get there, because if there's CD30 on the normal exocrine cells, it should get attracted to that area.
There you go. So, I got it. Bevacizumab and ruxolitinib and pancreatic
cancer. There you go.
But that's my new dream thing.
But I want to make sure it's a rare, I mean, it's uncommon. It's not a black box. It is added to the label, which I think is fair, just so practitioners know that if somebody presents with abdominal pain, at least have that on your differential, pancreatitis.
Wow, that is an amazing story. In terms of Hodgkin, anything else that's come out the last few months in general that you want to comment on, any trials out there? I mean, from what I globally can see, to me, the big story seems to be bevacizumab and moving it into first line, but you tell me.
Yeah, no, I think number one is bevacizumab and moving into the front line. We're currently, as the cooperative groups in the U.S. are working together, we're actually working with the COG, Children's Oncology Group, and trying to come up with a massive frontline early stage Hodgkin study integrating bevacizumab. So we don't have a final design yet, but the Alliance is working hard on trying to lead that effort. So if that's story A, I would say story B or theme B would be still trying to flesh out the whole response adapted strategies. In other words, you know, early PET scans after 2 cycles. And so looking at it 2 ways, you know, we know it, again, we fall back on the prognostic. So we know it's prognostic that if your PET scan is still positive after 2 cycles, you're going to do poorly. Your 2-year PFS is anywhere from 10 to 30% if you stay on ABVD. And conversely, obviously, if your PET scan is negative, is your, even for advanced stage, your predicted PFS is 80 to 90%. So the different strategies, obviously, that are looking at, and we saw a glimpse of data from the RAPID study, and you didn't see that at ASH, Neil, because we had every 3 years, there's the Cologne International Hodgkin Lymphoma Meeting. So it was just last October. So all of the Hodgkin's data got presented in Cologne, and they weren't allowed to re-present it. So there wasn't a lot of Hodgkin's, frankly, at ASH this year. So what the RAPID study, led by John Radford in the United Kingdom, was a pretty straightforward study. It was all-comer early-stage Hodgkin's, and they gave 3 cycles ABVD. Did a PET scan.
They presented that at ASH 2012,
They did, right? They did. And so this was a little more mature at Cologne, and it basically showed the same finding was, and did a PET scan after 3 cycles. If you're positive, you got a 4th and receive radiation. But for most patients, about 75% were PET negative. You randomized to radiation or no therapy. And it's never a clean result. I wish it could be black and white, but the results showed. So if you looked at intent to treat, there was no statistical difference. There was like an absolute difference to the radiation in PFS of maybe 3 or 4% to radiation versus no radiation. If you looked at only therapy received, again, kind of going back to try to exclude some patients who, in other words, there were some patients assigned to receive radiation who didn't receive it and some not assigned who did receive it that dirtied the water. So if you only looked at as therapy received, there was a statistical difference, albeit PFS only, and the absolute difference of 8% to radiation. So it depends who's looking at those results on your conclusion. My conclusion is for PET negative patients, if this holds true, that you can obviate radiation. Now, is there going to be a slight increased risk of relapse, maybe 5 to 6% that you need to salvage somehow yes, I think that's true. But if it's me versus having to choose between giving 100 patients radiation versus salvaging 5 patients, and it doesn't have to be a transplant. They didn't salvage all their patients with a transplant. I would choose the latter. So I think that's an interesting analysis. I can just let you know, there's another ongoing, again, led by the UK, Peter Johnson this time, in advanced stage. And it's a simple design. You could argue it's not a game changer, but what they're doing for patients who are PET negative after 2 cycles of ABVD, they're dropping the bleomycin. And so, in other words, continuing 4 cycles of AVD or staying with 6 of ABVD. So to me, it'll be important. If that study is quote-unquote positive, at least we'll be able to delete bleomycin, only have to give 2 cycles in advanced stage Hodgkin's, if that stays the standard, assuming B-vedotin. We'll have to see how that data fleshes out.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. I wanted to ask you about 2 other papers from Ashel and B-vedotin and about one general issue, but one of them was looking at cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, and that was by Madeline Duvick, and another was looking at a bunch of patients with B-cell lymphomas. A lot of them had diffuse large B-cell by Nancy Bartlett. Can you talk about those 2 papers and where you think B-vedotin is heading, you know, beyond anaplastic large cell and Hodgkin?
Yeah, I like both of those, especially the Bartlett study. And it was presented on a Tuesday. You know, sometimes these, you know, what gets presented on Tuesday, there's obviously the attendance seems half as much. But gosh, I thought that was one of the most important presentations at ASH, was Nancy Bartlett's study. So yeah, we don't think of diffuse large B-cell as being strongly CD30 positive, although you will see some who are 80, 90% CD30 positive. You'll see some that are 1%. And so they showed, I think, in a very hard-to-treat patient population, relapse refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, they showed a pretty respectable single-agent response rate was one conclusion. And the second conclusion was, and we're starting to see this theme with other B-vedotin studies, is it was irrespective of intensity of CD30. So whether you're 1% or 90%. And so what I think, to me, it almost harkens back a little bit on the Denny-Lukin Diffitox data. Remember that CD25, and what ultimately was coming out was it didn't matter what your CD25 was, you still responded. So I think part of that is, okay, obviously this is chemotherapy and there might be some off-target effect, but Nancy showed some really interesting data. I don't remember the exact technology, but it was more of like a high-res immunohistochemistry in a case that with our typical CD30 antibody looked like a 1%, but with this newer antibody staining, it looked 30 to 40%. So I think it's probably a lot as a sensitivity of our currently commercial antibody IHC stains, and there likely is more CD30 or CD20 for that matter for rituximab or any of these antibody drug conjugates than we really appreciate is a big part of it.
The thing from a clinical point of view that's a little scary is if you use the available, you know, assays, you're going to get people who are reading out as CD30 negative, not 1%, but CD30 negative that respond to this agent.
That's exactly right. And I think they have anticipated that. And so they have studies ongoing now of looking at B-vedotin in CD30 negative patients. And I think that's what we need to do, because that is not coming out as an important marker, whether you respond or not. So now, with that said, my bet will be in CD30 negative versus positive will be a lower response rate, but at least, yeah, you don't want to exclude a patient from therapy based on because our technology is not able to pick up that certain marker.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you about, and again, having spent the entire weekend, if you could imagine lung cancer. Can you imagine that nowadays?
I cannot. You know, I'm sorry, Neil.
13 investigators. I mean, 14 hours, and we didn't even talk about everything we could have talked about. It was unbelievable.
God love them. Yeah, no, that's great.
Yeah, it's been awesome. But in any event, as you can imagine, we did talk a little bit about ALK-positive disease, and not just crizotinib, but what was really exciting was the next generation of ALK inhibitors. But I want to get your thoughts on the paper that was presented at ASH. I think there had been a couple of cases presented previously of responses with crizotinib and ALK-positive lymphoma, but this was a larger series. What do they see there?
Very impressive activity of crizotinib in CD30-positive lymphomas. And I think, was it 10 of 11 responders? Almost 100%.
9 CRs,
yeah,
out of the 10.
Pretty
yeah.
darn
9
active.
CRs.
And yeah, you'd like to see higher numbers, but if that holds true, I mean, that would even be more active than B-vedotin. So an important question in that, had any of those patients received prior B-vedotin? And he said in that study, no, but he has an ongoing study. So it's just a personal communication with the senior author that he has at least two patients now who have failed Bevacizumab who have responded to crizotinib, two ALCL patients. So that's apparently an ongoing study. So obviously it's a niche, but I think it's exciting. Is it going to replace Bevacizumab? Bevacizumab had their foot in the door first, so it's going to be hard to replace them. But
what about the combination?
That's exactly right. And so could that be a combination, as we had alluded to with mantle cell, as we're getting novels into frontline therapy? I think that's where we're going and where we should be going.
So a lot's going on in CLL, but I'm curious about your take on the big ASH plenary data set and then a New England Journal paper on the type 2 anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody obinutuzumab combined with chlorambucil.
My take on it, it was better than expected. I mean, I think many people anticipated that obinutuzumab chlorambucil would be better than chlorambucil. And maybe we argued, too, that it would be a little better than rituximab, but it was definitively better. In other words, obinutuzumab chlorambucil versus rituximab chlorambucil was definitively better. The PFS, now it was just PFS, there wasn't overall survival, but still, nevertheless, progression-free survival was almost doubled in obinutuzumab chlorambucil versus rituximab chlorambucil. And a very large separation in those PFS curves. And it's pretty impressive. And it's one that its approval is for just that. It's for frontline with chlorambucil in the frontline setting. Now, how many of us still use chlorambucil? I'll still in maybe very elderly patients, but this was actually a more liberal design. Basically, patients who could not go on the CLL8 German study went on this study. So in other words, it was either FCR or this. There was not a bendamustine option in that. So I think that's kind of data. Obviously, we'll want to see how does this extrapolate. And there was something presented, I believe, at ASH, combining obinutuzumab with bendamustine, and as we start to combine it with other agents. But I think likely where this is going to end up is that'll be the frontline antibody to combine with whatever chemotherapy will be obinutuzumab. I mean, it very clearly was superior in efficacy to rituximab in CLL.
And right now, I mean, I don't even know if it's possible to give it with anything other than chlorambucil, but would you want to give it with, for example, bendamustine?
Again, I'm a purist, so I hate to say off of a study, but it is reality that we do start to extrapolate. And I always, in some respects, I say, well, what if it was me? What if it was a family member? And we wanted to give chemotherapy. I probably would say yes. Based on that data, it's hard not to imagine that there's some bizarre synergy of obinutuzumab and chlorambucil. You're likely going to see that superiority, at least in CLL. I wouldn't extrapolate it to other lymphomas. I think there's something unique in CLL, but there are those other studies that you're going to have to ask those questions in diffuse large B-cell, in follicular. Is this going to get similar superiority to rituximab? And I'm sure the company is thinking about those questions, but I would say, yeah, it's probably going to be the go-to in terms of frontline therapy. Now, you could ask the downstream question of that. So let's say we treat with obinutuzumab bendamustine or obinutuzumab whatever, and somebody progresses. Does that mean we never use rituximab? So in other words, if you're resistant to obinutuzumab, do we just continue the obinutuzumab? Do we try rituximab? Obviously, are there going to be newer antibodies? It's a question we've not had to answer before. You know, usually with rituximab, there's no rhyme or reason to that, but we'll typically, if someone progresses, whatever salvage will add continue in the rituximab. So we'll have to think through those issues. Do we just continue the obinutuzumab? Do we switch over to rituximab? Could there be a patient population that's sensitive to one antibody but not the other? Will be interesting to see.
Have you used obinutuzumab outside of a trial setting?
Not outside of a trial. No, I have not. I know it got approved last fall. We participated in, we called it at the time, a G-CHOP, because of GA101, study for frontline diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And it's similar. The only difference I could garner was it does seem you do have a little higher incidence and intensity of infusion reaction. And so actually in the CLL data, which I think is important to remember, it's divided up in the first cycle, not just weekly, but a day one and a day two. And the reason they did that is because of increased allergic reactions, infusion reactions. Now patients get acclimated and tolerant to it, but it definitely is something that I think practitioners will have to get used to, that it's more common, more intense than rituximab.
In your own mind, when you think about the way you conceptualize the biology of CLL, the biology of B-cell lymphomas, and how rituximab and obinutuzumab work, how do you sort of put it together, the fact that you saw this advantage?
Well, And I'm not a chemical biologist or understand all the stoichiochemistry, but my understanding is it's the way it binds to the CD20, and it binds it at an angle. And so the way it binds, it leads to less complement-related cell death. Because that's always been questioned, is that good or bad, the amount of complemented cell death? And some series have shown it's not necessarily a good thing. And so there's actually more stronger direct kill and more ADCC. So I think just literally by its chemistry of how it binds the epitope CD20 at this elbow, at this hinge, that it allows for just stronger direct cell kill.